The commander of Apollo 16, John Young, has flown three times before. This is going to be your fourth mission. John, I suspect you're going to have some of the highest hours in space, longest hours in space of all the astronauts by the time this program ends, won't you?
No, won't be Jim Lovell, Rhett. He'll still have the most, and I guess he's welcome to them. But I really have enjoyed my last three space flights, and I think this one is really going to be really a premier type flight to the highlands on the moon. I think we're going to see some things that nobody's ever seen before close up, and I think some of the data we're going to be able to bring back are going to send scientists back to their drawing boards again. I think it should be really interesting.
You're going to have to go some to top the site that Scott and Irwin saw.
Oh, yeah. Well, once you get up close to some of the areas that we're going to, I think it'll be tough to tell the difference between our mountains and their mountains. Theirs were a lot higher, but ours are pretty high, and we'll be a lot closer to them.
John, just for our audience overseas and for the many people listening around the world, tell us just a bit about yourself. In fact, all of this crew is from the deep south in this country, so we'll hear southern drawls all the way down the line this time, won't we?
Oh, yeah, everybody talks like they have a mouthful of grits. It's going to be pretty bad.
you grew up in Florida, right?
Oh, yeah. I was born in San Francisco, but at the age of two, I was transported to a little town in Georgia and lived there till I was six, and then moved to Florida and went to high school in Orlando, Florida, then moved back to Georgia to go to college in Atlanta and
Georgia Tech.
Had Georgia Tech, right.
And aeronautical engineer?
Yep, that's right. And after completing that, I was assigned to a destroyer in the Navy.
Did you get to flying in the Navy through ROTC in college? Is that what led you to the Navy and flying?
I was, I had an NROTC scholarship at Georgia Tech, and when I graduated, I was an ensign, and they sent me to a destroyer out in San Diego, and we stayed on there for a year, part of the time we spent in Korea, and I was very pleased to get those orders to flight training, finally.
Yeah, and you didn't fly much off of a destroyer, for sure.
No, you don't fly much. You go up and down and around a lot, but you don't fly very often.
And what did you fly in the service? What airplanes did you get into?
Well, I fortunately ended up in jet fighter planes and made a couple of cruises off the Coral Sea when it was a straight deck, the USS Coral Sea, flying F-9, F-8 Cougars. And that was back in the old days. They don't even call them that anymore. And then we got the F-8 U Crusader, which they call the F-8As, I guess they were. Mm-hmm. And we made a cruise in the Mediterranean on the USS Forrestal, and we're flying off that ship both day and night with a 1,000-mile-an-hour jet fighter. It was a lot of fun and a really good experience. After I finished that, I applied to go to the test pilot school, Navy test pilot school. And after my third application, I got accepted and went to test pilot school, where I was fortunate enough to be my instructor was Pete Conrad, and I went to work when I got out of the test pilot school for Jim Lovell. And so we're all about in the same boat, and then we were picked for the same group of astronauts back in 1962, which I guess is a long time ago. And
you've had a lot of action under the bridge since then.
Yes, we're really fortunate in that we're just getting in to the program before the Gemini program started and before they even could spell Apollo.
You flew with Gus Grissom and the first man, Gemini 3, right?
Yep, Gus and I flew Gemini 3, and then...
You and Mike?
Right, I was fortunate enough to back up Gemini 6 with Wally and Wally Schirra and Tom Stafford, and then was myself and Mike Collins were on Gemini 10, and after that, Tom Stafford, Gene Cernan, and myself backed up the Apollo 7 mission. And then we were assigned to the Apollo 10 mission and were lucky enough to get to the moon. And then I got to be the...
You guys first orbited the moon there. And then the LEM went down low just before Armstrong and Aldrin landed it. I'm refreshing our listeners' memory
just
here.
Just a couple of months before Apollo 11.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I was assigned on as backup commander with Jack Swigert and Charlie Duke on Apollo 13.
Mm-hmm. And then on to the prime crew for Apollo 16.
With Ken Mattingly and Charlie Duke. I'm really proud to be flying with those guys because I can't tell you how nice it is to be working with a bunch of professionals. Of course, I've been in this thing since almost the first day. But Ken and Charlie are really sharp, and they really know their vehicles. Ken knows the command and service module inside and out. He's been working with the SIM bay since the first day it was invented. Charlie knows the lunar module inside and out, and he's been working with the rover since its inception.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, John Young. John, you're going to one of the most interesting possible sites on the moon for the first time, to the highlands or true upland areas of the moon. This is something which has been a bit confusing. You would have thought that the Hadley Rill was highlands area, seeing all of those mountains towering around. That was really a Mare, extension of a Mare plain, wasn't it?
Yes,
in comparison
yes, it was.
To what you are.
And, of course, from in terms of highlands, we're landing on the top of the big mountains, essentially, that you were looking at in Apollo 15 site. Our site is about 4,500 meters higher than the Apollo 15 site was. And the Apollo 11 site, which is about 300 kilometers northeast of our site, we're about 6,000 meters higher than those guys were when they landed. So the moon is really a place of contrast. We're landing in the equivalent of a place like we might be considered as landing at the top of the Andes Mountains.
Or a great plateau in the Himalayas.
It's a giant plateau, and it's very elevated. And the countryside is about like you'd find on a high mountainous plateau. In our site itself, the slopes, the terrain is hummocky and sloping. But there are two good mountains. One mountain is two good hills, I should say. One to the south of our landing site, about 2 kilometers south of where we're landing, is 375 meters higher than a landing site. One to the north is about 325 meters higher than we're landing. Now, that's about 4 kilometers north of where we're landing.
How would you describe and summarize the purpose of the overall mission, John?
Well, I like to think of it as a lunar highlands exploration mission. We're going to be going down and getting ground truth at the landing site itself. In the meantime, Ken and the command service module will be flying overhead, and his sensors will be looking at the same data that looking in our landing site will be looking at the same data that we're picking up for ground truth. Ground truth, yes. We should be able to take those rocks and all samples and the geophysical data that we're gathering down in our landing site, and with Ken's data, which encompasses a great deal of the moon because of the ground track and is over a lot of highlands areas, particularly in the backside of the moon, we should be able to take that and extrapolate it to being able to say what this part of the moon and what that part of the moon is really made of. In other words, we'll have cranked back our data in our small landing site to say what a large part of the makeup of the moon really is.
And you're going to be there 3 days with 3 7-hour excursions.
Right, 3 7-hour EVAs. Well, we'll be up there a total of 6 days with Ken's orbits.
Mm-hmm.
Our first EVA, I guess I'll summarize very shortly. Our first EVA is a deploying the Apollo Lunar Scientific Experiments package and offloading the rover, and that activity will take about 4.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll proceed 1.5 kilometers out due west of our site to a crater called Flag Crater. Now, Flag Crater is about 300 meters across. It's about 40 meters deep, and that will allow us to sample down into the Cayley. You may know the theory of impact craters is that the the impact crater leaves the material from the deepest part of the crater right on the rim. We should have no trouble getting to the rim of those craters, and we'll be able to sample from the rim and therefore getting Cayley material, which is the plains of our landing site, is the Cayley Plains. We'll be able to get that material down to 40 meters.
You get not only the Cayley Plain site, but also some mountainous materials when you sample the mountains.
Right. Uh-huh. We'll be going on the EVA 2. We'll be going the second 7-hour EVA. We'll be going 3.9 kilometers due south, almost, to halfway up Stone Mountain, 160, 70 meters up the side of that mountain. In the last half a kilometer, Stone Mountain rises at, it's relatively flat right up to the last half kilometer, and then it rises at 175 meters. So we'll be going up local slopes, which are probably going to vary from 8 to 15 or maybe even 20 degrees.
That'll be a challenge for the rover then, won't it?
I think it'll be very exciting to see if the rover can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be some real off-the-road driving for us guys in full-pressure suits with a motor vehicle on the moon.
Yeah, and then the third EVA, you sample a
third EVA, crater. We go up to a bright raid crater up north, and it's a very spectacular crater. It's equivalent of our meteor crater out in Arizona. I don't know if you've ever seen that or not. But it's about 1,000 meters across, and it's about 200 meters deep. It's a pretty deep crater. Mm-hmm. And the walls are very steep, 45 degrees. We're hoping to be able to get up to the edge of it and look into it with our television and show the viewers back on Earth just how spectacular those bright raid craters are. But by sampling off the rim of North Ray Crater, we'll be obtaining material that's 200 meters deep in the moon. And I think the important thing about that is that we'll actually know where the material came from, because with our photos and everything, we'll be able to almost put the pieces back in place.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, John, for giving us this overall summary of the mission of Apollo 16. John, I think the most exciting, pure scientific experiment on the mission of Apollo 16 is going to turn not to the surface of the moon, but out into deep space, and you're going to be the man to set up this low ultraviolet light camera. Tell us about it.
Well, I think that is very exciting. I've always been interested in astronomy, and I think here we have an opportunity with this camera, which is has a 20-degree field of view and is really a telescope, to add some significant qualitative and quantitative about our knowledge of both our Earth's geocorona and the hydrogen and the ultraviolet spectra in the bodies of interest around the universe.
Now, that's pretty heavy stuff there. So let's talk about what that geocorona is and what that hydrogen in deep space is.
The Earth is surrounded. Fortunately for us, it's surrounded by a sheath, and it protects us. It protects us from the ultraviolet light from sources like the sun. And if it didn't, we wouldn't be here. I'll tell you that. But it also hurts us in that the people who view things, astronomers, would like to see just exactly what kind of radiation they are getting from bodies like the sun, like the stars in the galaxies, and like the giant features in around the cosmos. Well, once you place an ultraviolet camera on the moon, you're then out of the Earth's geocorona, and at least theoretically you should be able to see things like intergalactic hydrogen, which is a hydrogen that astronomers have long theorized makes up 90% of the mass of the universe. Well, we don't know if that's a fact or not, and with this camera we could be able to prove it. And if it doesn't make up 90% of the universe's mass, why, it's back to the old drawing board.
You'll have the answer, hopefully,
yes,
with this one single experiment. And nothing else like this is going to be flown in any of the remaining missions, in the other missions.
No, it's very exciting to me. It's a very intelligent way of getting that thing, just using space as a platform. And of course, if it works and it has the potential of working, why, we should have some real interesting information for astronomers everywhere.
And you're going to bring back this film from the camera, and it'll give the scientists work at the drawing board for a year or so, won't it?
I think so. We're going to take a number of films. The Little Rascal, all you have to do is point it, and it runs through a stepped program of exposures from 3 minutes up to 200 minutes. And then we repoint it at another target, reset it, and start it again. And at the end of the EVA, we take the film off in a very simple manner and leave the camera on the moon, but bring the film back.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's got a lot of potential of getting some very significant information for astronomy.
And we'll be hearing results from this for many, many months as the analyses are made.
I think so. And, of course, that's true of all experiments that we're leaving on the moon.
Thanks very much, John Young, commander of Apollo 16. This is Rhett Turner. Well, John, we've heard about that exciting ultraviolet light camera you'll be pointing out into space. Let's talk about some of the other interesting equipment you'll be using on the surface of the moon. The ALSEP experiments package, the Apollo Lunar Scientific Experiments Package, if I've got the acronym correct.
Yes, I think you got it.
Let's go.
The Apollo program couldn't run without acronyms, and we got a million of them. But that's a good answer for that one. The passive seismic experiment is one of the packages on our ALSEP. It allows us to measure moon quakes. We have an active seismic experiment in which we actually fire charges into the surface of the moon, much like the geophysicists use on Earth to discover oil. Mm-hmm. Only we'll be looking for things like significant changes in the velocity of sound in the surface, which might indicate the presence of water, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The heat flow experiment, which they deployed successfully on Apollo 15 with a drill, will allow us to determine the internal energy of the moon by the amount of heat coming out of it. And we have the lunar surface magnetometer, which will allow us to measure the magnetic field of the moon. We also have a portable magnetometer on the back of the rover, which will be making measurements out and away from the lunar module to see if there are any significant changes in the vicinity of our landing site, which might be indicative of something like, for example, ore deposits, or might be indicative of the way impacts change magnetic fields.
Mm-hmm. Well, your mission, again, has as its overall purpose scientific objectives and not too much engineering checkout at all, just as Apollo 15 did, doesn't it?
Yes, I think the data that we're able to bring back with all the scientific experiments package that we've got on a vehicle make these truly exciting from a scientific standpoint, and they really enable us to get quantum-type jumps on our knowledge about a planetary body that's as old as the moon seems to be. And that kind of information, I think, one of these days when we really get smart, is just absolutely going to be essential to us making a go of it right here on our own planet.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, John Young. This is Rhett Turner at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. John, this will be the second time that there will be this lunar roving vehicle, and you're going to do some interesting things with that. Hopefully climb a mountain at a fairly steep angle, right?
Right. Hopefully climb a mountain that has slopes of somewhere between 12 and 20 degrees, and hopefully negotiate our way through a block field up at North Ray Crater and get up to the rim of that baby. Now, we've been practicing doing that out at Kennedy Space Center, and they fixed me up a traverse trail. And the other day, I was able to, by weaving in and out of boulders and going around the corners that they've set up out there, even with a very devious course that they had set up, I was able to go 13 kilometers, averaging about 12 kilometers an hour.
Uh-huh. But this whole site, not only the mountains, but the Cayley Plain area, is expected to be pretty lumpy, isn't it, with a lot of rocks?
It is, and we've planned for it by, we're only allowing, we've planned our EVAs, estimating that we'll only be able to make 7.3 kilometers an hour.
Uh-huh.
Which is much reduced over the top. That's about a half as fast as a rover could really travel.
Uh-huh. And hopefully, as I understand it, you are going to search for a stretch in which you can test the rover out and
yes,
see how it performs.
We have a couple of test objectives, and these are engineering test objectives, just to see how the rover performs on a flat space, and to look at the surface cohesiveness of the moon. They think by analyzing the rover motions that they'll be able to tell just how glassy or how cohesive the lunar surface is, and maybe one of the answers to that would be better wheels for operating on a surface such as the moon is.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, John Young, commander of Apollo 16, and good luck throughout the mission.
Thank you, Red.